Small is the gate and narrow the path that leads to life. Hello, Philadelphia. You're tuned in to The Narrow Path with teacher and scholar Steve Gregg on Heritage News Talk, WWDB. Over 2,000 years ago, a Jewish carpenter stood up against the powers that be and said and did things that changed the course of human history. Today, Steve will open up the phone lines to address what you would like to know about what was said and did in the Bible. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you about what it takes to find the narrow path that leads to life. When the radio show is over, we encourage you to go to thenarrowpath.com, where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your phone calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian life or the Christian faith, you may call and we'll talk about them here. If you see things differently than I do and want to present an alternate viewpoint on some point, feel free to call. We'll talk about that together as well. The number to call, and I'm not sure if you'll find a line open at this moment or not, but if you do not, if it's busy, feel free to call back in a few minutes. You'll need this number. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And just a couple of quick announcements for those of you living in Southern California and for those living in the Sacramento area who are listening to the program. In Southern California, once a month, I have a teaching meeting that I lead in Temecula, and that's coming up this Saturday night. It's only once a month, and I'm talking about the subject of the Hebrew Roots and Torah Observant Movement. Now, if you don't know what that is, then you don't get out much, because there's obviously a lot of people out there saying that Christians should be keeping the Sabbath, should be keeping the Jewish feasts, that we should be observing the Torah, that Jesus himself observed the Torah and told us to do so, that Paul observed the Torah, some say. This is what we're told. That means we're supposed to keep the Jewish law. Now, if you haven't heard that view, like I said, you don't get out much because it's everywhere. It's on Christian radio. It's on the Internet all over the place. And you'll meet individuals all the time nowadays who are convinced of this or considering it. So if you are either in that movement or you hold that view or know people who are, or want to be ready for people who are, if you meet them, join us this Saturday night in Temecula. The location and time are at our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Click on the link that says announcements, and you'll find all the information you need about that. Now, I want to encourage those who hold these Torah observance views, even Seventh-day Adventists who do not hold all these views but hold, of course, the Sabbath view, anyone who wishes, who disagrees with my position, I welcome you to come because there will be opportunity for questions and answers and raising objections and so forth. So I'll be glad to answer any challenges and objections on this subject. This Saturday night in Temecula, go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, click on the tab that says Announcements and find the time and location of the meeting. Likewise, in the Sacramento area, or more properly, Auburn, I'll be at the end of this month teaching an all-day seminar on a Saturday, the last Saturday of the month, about marriage. And if you're interested in that, whether you're married or not, the name of the topic is what you absolutely need to know before and after you get married. So if you haven't gotten married yet, or if you have, you still need to know this about marriage. And that's coming up at the end of this month in Auburn. Once again, there is there's information at our website at thenarrowpath.com, at the tab that says announcements, and I welcome you to go there and join us. I believe since they are actually providing a lunch for those who come, because it's an all-day thing, and the lunch is free, I believe, they do need you to RSVP and let them know you're coming so that they'll know how many people to feed. So you go to the website and RSVP if you want to join us in Auburn at the end of this month. I think that's the 26th of this month. All right, now our lines are filled, and I need to talk to some of these callers so that they don't go away out of impatience. Terrence from Las Vegas, Nevada, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking the call, Steve, and the question. After I ask it, I'll hang up and take it over the air. Regarding Philippians 1:6, Romans 8:29, can that be married to Philippians 1:6?
Well, Philippians 1:6 says that God will be faithful to complete or perform the work that he has begun in the church in Philippi. And Romans 8:29 talks about those whom God foreknew he predestinated to become conformed to the image of God's Son. So there is definitely an overlap of subject matter there, because Paul indicates in Romans that God has a plan for those that he has saved, that they will ultimately be changed, conformed into the image of Christ. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians 3:18, we all with unveiled faces, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are changed from glory to glory into that same image. So it's God's purpose that Christians will be transformed or changed into the image of Christ, and that's what Romans 8:29 also says. Now, Philippians 1:6 does not necessarily specify what that purpose is. Of course, Paul states it in other places. He probably assumes the Philippians know it, and he says that God, who has begun the good work in you, will perform it until the day of Christ Jesus. So I think that both of these verses speak of the destiny that God has, that he's working in his people to become like Christ, and both of them more or less guarantee that God's purpose will be fulfilled in us.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. Have a blessed day.
All right, Terrence. Thanks for your call, brother. Good talking to you. Okay, our next caller is Ron from San Diego, California. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. God bless you. Your answer yesterday brought up another question about sonship and Abraham's offspring. He had 8 offspring, but 2 sons. Is that correct?
Well, he had 8 sons.
Okay.
First was Ishmael.
So all eight of them had the blessings of God the same as Ishmael and Isaac?
No. Ishmael was the firstborn son. Isaac was the second. And there were 6 more that were born to a woman named Keturah, who is said that apparently Abraham married her after Sarah died. So she would have been his second wife. Of course, Sarah had given him her handmaid, Hagar, and that woman bore the first child of Abraham. But he had 1 by Hagar, 1 by Sarah, and 6 by Keturah. Now, only the one that Sarah gave him, only Isaac, had the blessing, the special blessing that was promised to Abraham and to his seed. Now, Ishmael also had a blessing, but it wasn't the same blessing. He just received a blessing like any son might receive a blessing from his father, but it wasn't the blessing of the Abrahamic covenant that Ishmael received. Ishmael, therefore, was not really in any different category than the other 6 sons whom Abraham had by Keturah. Isaac alone was the son of promise.
But the other 6 sons were given gifts and sent away, is that correct?
Right. Abraham gave gifts to each of his sons and sent them away and then allowed Isaac to inherit everything. The gifts he gave them, we don't know what they were or how substantial, but he didn't send them away empty-handed. When he sent them away, he gave them something to live on, apparently, but we don't have any knowledge of how much. Abraham was an exceedingly wealthy man, and even if he had been very generous in his gifts to them, it would have totaled only a tiny fraction of what he had for Isaac to receive.
But didn't he ask God to bless Ishmael, and that's why Ishmael had 12 sons that became 12 mighty tribes?
Well, that's not necessarily why Ishmael had 12 sons. Abram did ask God to bless Ishmael, and he did so actually before Isaac was born. Before Isaac was born, God told Abram that he was going to have Isaac, and Abram was somewhat resistant to the idea because he was old and Sarah was old. He said, well, God, here's Ishmael, just bless him. In other words, God, don't go to any trouble by making my 90-year-old wife get pregnant. That's not necessary. We already have Ishmael, so let Ishmael live before you. And God said, well, I will bless him too. He'll be blessed, and there will be 12 princes that come from him. That doesn't mean that the 12 princes came from him because of Abraham's prayer. It may be that they did, or maybe God just knew that's what was going to happen, and he felt that Abraham needed to know that Ishmael was not going to come to nothing. But no doubt, if Abraham had asked, God could have told him things about the future of the other six sons, too. We just don't have any record of any such conversations.
Did the one which was called Midian from Keturah become the tribe of Midian?
Yes.
And Abraham, Moses' father-in-law?
Yes.
And yes. Were the other six, did they all become tribes as well?
Probably. We don't know very much about most of them. One of them is named Shua. And we find that in the book of Job, one of his friends is called Bildad the Shuahite, and so scholars assume that the Shuahite came from Shua, which was another son of Abraham by Keturah. As far as the other four, they're not very significant, so the Bible doesn't trace their genealogies.
Okay, that was just a question.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Steve. God bless you.
All right, thanks for your call. Good talking to you. Tim from Santa Ana, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Steve, for taking my call.
Yeah.
Does Ezekiel 37 through 39 refer to the regathering of the Jews back into the land in 1948, or has the prophecy already been fulfilled? And then secondly, does the Gog and Magog entities in Ezekiel have anything to do with the Gog and Magog we find in Revelation chapter 20?
All right. Obviously, you're going to find people who differ from me on this one, but I don't believe that Ezekiel 37 is talking about 1948. I believe it's referring to what began in 586 BC, 539 BC, when Cyrus gave his decree that allowed Israel to go back from Babylon to rebuild their nation. The prophecy depicts a valley of dry bones, just scattered dry bones, and God says to Ezekiel, can these bones live? Well, it certainly didn't look like they could, but Ezekiel realized that if the question was being asked, maybe there's something he doesn't know, so you tell me. And so God said, prophesy to these bones. And so he prophesied to them, and they rattled and stood up and assembled themselves into skeletons, and then flesh came on them and so forth, and they looked like humans instead of bones, but there was no breath in them. They weren't alive yet. And then God said, prophesy to the wind, or possibly the spirit, because the word wind and spirit are the same, ruach in the Hebrew. And so he did, and the spirit apparently came in them, and they came alive. Now, God basically says, this is a reference to Israel in their captivity in Babylon. In verse 11, he says, then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They indeed say, now this is present tense. He's not talking about some future Israel. He's talking about Israel in Ezekiel's own time. Ezekiel himself was in Babylon with the captives there. And so Israel was away from their own land. They were in captivity. And what they were saying at the time was, our bones are dry, our hope is lost, for we ourselves are cut off. So they were basically saying, there's no future for us. We're cut off from our nation Israel. We're like a bunch of dried up bones. There's no hope for us. That was Israel's attitude in Babylon. And then he says in verse 12, therefore prophesy and say to them, thus says the Lord God, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up from your graves, and I will bring you into the land of Israel. Now, he's not speaking about literal graves here. He's talking about the imagery of the prophecy, these bones, which were not in graves after all, but they were dead bodies. They were reassembled. And then the spirit came into them. He's talking about, this is a reference to God gathering the Jews together again and bringing them back to their land of Israel, which he did, of course, through the decree of Cyrus. He brought the remnant back. And So the nation was reassembled and organized again under Zerubbabel and Joshua in around 538 B.C., but the Spirit had not come upon them. Now, this is what the bones assembled into human bodies without breath in them represents. The outward form of the nation had been restored after, mm-hmm. Cyrus's decree, but there still wasn't the Spirit or the breath of life in them. That's why these bodies were first seen to be simply physically assembled, but not alive. And so he says in verse 13, "Then you shall know that I am the Lord when I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought up you from your graves, I will put my Spirit in you." Now that's the second thing. After he assembled them into an outward organism of a nation, there would come a time when he would pour his Spirit out on them. "And you shall live, and I will place you in your own land. Then you shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken and performed it," says the Lord. Well, he did pour out his Spirit upon them on the day of Pentecost. There were two phases to this prophecy. Israel had abandoned God for idols, and therefore God had abandoned them for 70 years in Babylon. However, although they were as good as dead as a nation, he would restore them. But this restoration would come in two phases. One would be the restoration of the actual political nation, which began in 538 B.C. The other would be a second work. That's why it's represented by Ezekiel making a second prophecy to the wind or to the Spirit, separate from the prophecy he made that gathered them into assembled bodies. And so the second work that God did to restore was to pour out his Spirit, as all the prophets, or many of the prophets said he would, Isaiah, Joel, Zechariah, and many others had spoken of God pouring out his Spirit on the remnant of Israel. Well, that remnant of Israel, of course, by the time God did this, they had come to the Messiah, and they were in the upper room, and they were in Jerusalem at the time the Spirit was fell upon them. And the remnant, the believing remnant of Israel, became filled with the Holy Spirit. And this became, of course, what we call the church, but it was all Jews. It was the remnant of Israel that became the church when God poured his Spirit on them. So there were two phases to the restoration mentioned in Ezekiel 37, the physical restoration of the nation, which happened almost over 500 years before Jesus was born, and then the pouring out of the Spirit upon them, which many of the prophets spoke about, and which occurred. And Peter, by the way, when the Spirit was poured out on Pentecost, said this is that which the prophet spoke about, that the Spirit would be poured out. So he identified Pentecost as the time that God had predicted. Peter specifically quotes from Joel, but he could have quoted from Isaiah or Ezekiel or Zechariah or Joel or, any number of other places in the Old Testament where God had said he was going to do this. So we have there not a reference to anything that happened in 1948, but two events, one that happened half a millennium before Jesus was born and one that happened a few weeks after Jesus ascended. And therefore, that prophecy was fulfilled. Now, when you come to chapter 38 and 39, we do have reference to an invasion of Israel after they've come back together as a nation. Of course, they did. They came back together as a nation 538 B.C. and in the years that followed. Sometime after that, when they were still, as it says, a land of unwalled villages, there was an aggressor that came against them. And that aggression is described in chapters 38 and 39. Now, the language is very apocalyptic. It sounds like a science fiction movie or an invasion from outer space or something like that, because these invaders are defeated by fire from the sky, fire and brimstone from the sky. Yeah. It takes 7 years to burn their weapons and 7 months to bury their dead, and 5/6 of their army is simply destroyed, seemingly supernaturally. Now, those who take this rather literally would say, well, that's got to be in the future, because, frankly, nothing like that has ever literally happened in any war that we know of. And therefore, many people take that war to be a future war, and they identify Gog and Magog with entities up in northeastern Europe, especially Russia. And this was especially popular back in the time of the Soviet Union for dispensational scholars to identify Gog and Magog with the Soviet Union, Russia. And they predicted that Russia would invade Israel and that this thing would literally happen. Fire from heaven would destroy them, 5/6 of them would be wiped out, and so forth. Now, of course, that's because dispensationalists don't have very much understanding of apocalyptic writing. The mention of fire and brimstone is definitely reminiscent of Sodom and Gomorrah, that these enemies are destroyed just like Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed. Not literally in the same way, but the judgment on them is connected in principle to the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. It was God avenging himself against wickedness. And the language of apocalyptic is very symbolic. The number seven is an extremely common symbolic number in apocalypse. Say that they, you know, 7 months to bury the dead, 7 years to burn the weapons. This all has the appearance of an apocalyptic passage. Now, I don't think it's referring to a future literal battle that fits these descriptions in a literal sense. Mm-hmm. After all, if you read about the battle in Ezekiel 38 and 39, they're wearing armor and using bows and arrows and spears. Obviously, you're not likely to see any future battle where people are riding horses using bows and arrows. So, you either have to say that some of the dramatic imagery is symbolic, whereas the bows and arrows and horseback are literal, or else you have to say that the dramatic apocalyptic imagery is literal and the horseback and bows and arrows are symbolic. That is, everybody has to take something symbolic and something literal. And I personally believe this is talking about an ancient battle. It's described in terms of an ancient battle. And there's two possibilities that have been suggested by Bible scholars. One is that it's a reference. It's a reference to the Persian crisis. Shortly after Israel was reestablished as a nation, there was a crisis upon Israel that was led by Haman, and in the days of Esther, and the Jews were in danger of being wiped out, but God sovereignly intervened to bring about the deliverance of the Jews. It was through ordinary warfare, but the language of apocalyptic would commonly use the kind of language we read about in Ezekiel. And so it could be God's deliverance from Israel in that crisis when the Persians were going to wipe them out. Or another suggestion that has been made is it could be Antiochus Epiphanes during the time of the Maccabean Wars, which was 168 years before Christ, 167 years before Christ. So in either case, both of these events happened after Israel came back together as a nation, which is how it's described in Ezekiel. And both of them, the Israelites were signally defended by God's clear blessing on their efforts. And so either of those wars could be a reference to it. Now, you mentioned Gog and Magog in Revelation 20. Revelation, the book of Revelation is sometimes called a rebirth of images. And what that means is, in fact, there was a commentary in Revelation written that was called a rebirth of images. The idea here is that Revelation, in giving its message, borrows imagery from all kinds of places in the Old Testament. It gives them a new application, but it uses the same images. For example, in Zechariah 4, Zerubbabel and Joshua are called the two olive trees that stand before the presence of the Lord. In Revelation 11, the two witnesses are called the two olive trees that stand in the presence of the Lord. The same image from Zechariah 4, but different guys. It's not not referring to those same people. Similarly, you have plagues like those in Egypt that recur in Revelation, and the Euphrates River drying up like it did when Persia conquered Babylon, and things like that. You've got all these images from the Old Testament replayed in the book of Revelation with new meanings, in a new context. Now, Gog and Magog, mentioned in Revelation 20, would, in my opinion, be an example of that same phenomenon. Gog and Magog appear only in Ezekiel 38 in the Bible. And the invaders against the church in Revelation 20, as I understand it, are likened to Gog and Magog. But that doesn't mean it's the same entities that invaded Israel, you know, hundreds of years before Christ. It would simply mean that those invasions of Israel, which could possibly be represented by the Gog-Magog prophecy, have their parallels in the warfare against the church in Revelation 20. That's how I would understand that. So it's not really the same Gog and Magog any more than the two olive trees in Revelation 11 are the same two olive trees in Zechariah 4.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Steve. Thank you so much.
All right, Tim. Thank you for your call. Good talking to you. All right. Our next caller is Scott from Roseville. Scott, how are you doing?
Well, I'm in dire straits, and your show.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Great comfort. The doctors are on it, but the stresses are great enough with my health. Then you can let the listeners know if you want to that I actually sweat blood. So all the major parts of my body.
Sorry, this call's
not about me. It's about you. Your show brings me great comfort, and I just wanted to ask you, short question, if you'd be broadcasting through KFIA through the end of 2017, please continue.
Well, I would say yes, assuming the support comes in. We know month by month if we're going to stay on any given station.
I don't have the internet, and I can't write a letter.
Yeah, I'm not making an appeal. I'm not making an appeal for money here. I'm just letting you know how things are. We're on about 22 stations now. Some of those stations are producing more in donations in their listeners than we're paying to those stations. Others are providing less, much less. Some have provided nothing because we've added a few newer stations the past several months, and some of them, I don't think we've gotten a donation or a phone call from any of them yet. So we don't really know how things will stand through the end of the year. But I will say KFIA is one of the stations that is not fully supporting itself at this point. That is, the listeners, we get more phone calls from there than almost anywhere else, and yet we don't get as many donations from there as we get from some other areas. But because some of the stations are overproducing, we've been able to subsidize the deficiency of what's coming in from the Sacramento area. So assuming the Lord continues to provide that way, yes, we'll stay on the air there through the end of the year and hopefully through the end of the decade and maybe to the end of my life. Who knows?
Please do. Thank you.
All right, brother. Thanks for your call. Okay, we'll talk to Paul. Actually, I better not talk to Paul quite yet because we're going to have a break coming up. Paul, hang on, and we will come back to you after our break. A few of our stations leave our network at this point. They take only the first half hour, not the second half hour of the program. However, the vast majority of our stations carry the full hour, and we will be coming back for another half hour in just a moment. Those of you who are leaving us, we want you to know that The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the bills that keep us on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you wish from the website, which is thenarrowpath.com. And whether you wish to donate or not, you should go to the website because everything there is free for you to take, and it's valuable stuff at thenarrowpath.com. For those of you staying with us, please hold on through the next 30 seconds, and we'll come back for another half hour. God bless.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour. This is our second half hour of the program. Those of you who listen to stations that pick up the program at this point and don't carry the first half hour, we'd just like you to know that the entire program, which is an hour every day, this is the second half, you can hear it from our website, thenarrowpath.com. Every day the program is streamed from the website, so you can hear it live. And also every day the program is archived at the website, so you can hear it later if you can't listen live. And these archives go back many years, so you can listen to our programs going back a long time if you visit thenarrowpath.com. Right now what we're doing is what we always do. We're taking phone calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you can call them in. We'll talk about them. If you see things differently than the host does, feel free to call and balance comment. The number to call is 844-484-5737. It looks like the phone lines may just be filling up just now, but if you get a busy signal, keep this number on hand and call in a few minutes and you'll probably get through. 844-484-5737. 37. All right, our next caller is Paul from Tyrone, Georgia. Hi, Paul. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I have a question about, I guess it's really two issues that are kind of interrelated. I'm trying to make up my mind what I think about the millennium and about the intermediate state of the dead.
Uh-huh.
When I was listening to one of your teachings on this, and you were talking about in Revelation 20, verse 4, the idea of whether people are, this first resurrection is people that are living again, like being resurrected, like brought back to physical life,
mm-hmm.
or whether they're
mm-hmm.
continue to live. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit in light of some of the arguments that people make about soul sleep and
okay.
what your thoughts are on that whole issue.
All right, sure. If we look at Revelation 20 and verse 12, it says, I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God. And the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. Oops, I'm actually looking a little further than I should. You should look way back here. Let's go back to verse 4. I saw thrones, and they who sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Now, this 1,000 years is mentioned 6 times in this chapter, and interestingly, nowhere else in the Bible. You don't have any other reference in the Bible to the 1,000-year reign except in Revelation 20, and here we have that expression, 6 times. Now, when it says they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years, some manuscripts say for the 1,000 years, meaning the 1,000 years that was mentioned earlier. This 1,000 years is the 1,000 years during which Satan is said to be bound. And then he's loosed for a little while at the end. Now, the differences of opinion about the millennium will have a lot to do with the way we understand this particular verse. The premillennial view holds that the millennium is a 1,000-year reign of Christ after Jesus returns and prior to the creation of the new heaven and the new earth. So they would understand there to be the coming of Christ, then the millennium, then the new heavens and the new earth. Now, that's the premillennial view. The amillennial view, which is the view that I've held for some time now, is the idea that the 1,000 years is symbolic for the present age. Now, I don't have time to defend both views or either view right now. I've done that on other occasions, and obviously you've heard my lectures on it. I do that a great deal, But the real question is, okay, if the 1,000 years is the present age, if it's symbolic for the present age, then what are we to think of these people reigning with Christ during this period of time? And if it's the period of time after Jesus comes back, if he sets up the 1,000-year reign, then what is it about these people that would tell us something helpful, these people who reign with Christ for the 1,000 years? Now, a premillennialist believes that Jesus comes back before this millennium, which means that the events described are on earth, and therefore those who are on thrones and reigning with Christ are on earth with Christ. Jesus has come back at the beginning of this period of time. He has brought back the saints with him, as the Bible says he will. He has raised the dead, and now these people are resurrected, and they're sitting on thrones on earth, reigning with Christ over the earth. And this is how the premillennial view would see it. Now, the amillennial view, there's more than one way the amillennial view has been understood, but as I understand it, these people are the souls of Christians who've died, and they are in heaven during the present age. Again, they are reigning during the 1,000-year reign, which the amillennialist associates with the present age. So the question would be, are these people, is it describing people who are currently, during this present age, are they their souls in heaven, reigning with Christ? Or are these people who, after Jesus comes back, will have been resurrected, they're in their physical resurrected bodies, and they're sitting on literal thrones on earth during the millennial reign of Christ? These are the two main options. I would suggest the wording of the passage tends to support the amillennial view, although, of course, it's not the principal support for the view. I think that we'd have to go through the entire chapter piece by piece to show what the real support for the amillennial view is. But given the amillennial assumption, this passage reads as we would expect, because it says, I saw thrones and they that sat on them, and judgment was committed to them, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the witness of Jesus. And it says, and they lived and reigned with Christ. So John is not seeing an earthly scene with people in resurrected bodies. He's seeing a heavenly scene with the souls of the saints. These people have been beheaded, so they've died. And it's during this present age that they have died for Christ. And during this present age, after they've died, they are reigning. Their souls are seen in heaven, reigning with Christ. I would point out that there's nothing in the entire chapter that mentions Jesus being on earth. And therefore, although some of the events happen on earth, some of them don't. Reigning with Christ is what saints do in heaven today. We will reign on the earth when he comes back, but we see that this is not what is there described. In fact, the resurrection of the bodies has not yet occurred when this happens, because you read at the end of the chapter of that, where the sea gives up its dead and Hades gives up the dead, there's a resurrection of the dead at the end of chapter 20. This is before that. This is, I believe, during the present age. And if it is not, if, in fact, the premillennial view is true, and that these people are on earth in their resurrected bodies, it's difficult to know why John would describe them as he saw their souls reigning with Christ. Now, I realize the word soul can be used to refer to a whole person. I'm anticipating that objection. However, it doesn't always refer to a whole person. It's very clear from the wording that this is not referring to the whole person, body, soul, and spirit, because it says, I saw the souls of them. If he said simply, I saw souls, and the phrase was no different than that, then he might simply mean I saw people without any reference to whether they're disembodied. But he says, I saw the souls of people. That's actually referring to the soul as a component of a person. It is the non-physical component of a person, in my understanding. And therefore, John sees the souls of the saints who have died reigning in heaven. Now, this, again, the whole validity of my point rests on the assumptions of amillennialism, which probably many of our listeners are not amillennial, and therefore they wouldn't see, that's not how they're going to see it. However, if it's not, if they are in bodies, if they are resurrected, living in a future millennium, then I do not know why Paul would, or why John would say, I saw the souls of them. Because the only time that a person's soul would be seen separated from the body would be between death and resurrection. Because Paul said, as long as we're in the body, we're absent from the Lord. That means while we're alive. But he said, I'm eager to depart from the body, obviously, and to be with the Lord, to be absent from the body. Now, if we're in the body, then people are not seeing our souls. They're just seeing us. When he raises the dead, likewise, our souls will be in bodies. The only time when you would see a soul not in a body would be between the time that person died and the time they're raised from the dead, the intermediate state, as you mentioned it. So that's how I would understand the relevance of this passage to that doctrine.
Can you tell me if there's any other place in Scripture that you could point to as evidence that there is a conscious existence in the disembodied state during this intermediate time or after the resurrection that's described there?
I alluded to a couple of them. The most famous one probably is in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, where he says in verse 6, therefore we're always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, yes, well pleased, rather, to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. So we are somebody other than our body. I am somebody other than my body because I'm present in my body now, and I will be absent from my body when I die. That's how Paul talks about it. There's who I am is defined separately from my body, just like now in my house. If I go out and run some errands later today, I'll be absent from my house. I am somebody other than my house, and I could be present or absent in my house. So I can also be present or absent in the body, present in the body or absent from the body. Now, that's a reference to the contrast between being physically alive or physically dead. So if I'm absent from my body, I'm disembodied. And he says, if we're absent from the body, we're present with the Lord. Now, we should realize that Paul is not referring to the resurrection of the last day, because when we're resurrected, we will not be absent from our bodies. We'll be in bodies again. There's only one time that you'd be absent from your body and not in a body, and that would be between the time you die and the time that the resurrection occurs. And so this would apparently be the same period of time that John is seeing in Revelation 20.
Okay. Any other places I should look to study that further as far as the intermediate state and the
well, there's not much on it. Yeah, there's not much on it in the Bible because the Bible isn't particularly interested in talking about post-mortem things. Right? Once in a while, there's an allusion to it, as we've seen. But the subject of the Bible is not what happens after you die. That's hardly an emphasis. It's not even mentioned in the Old Testament, which is, what, three-quarters of the Bible. And then the New Testament only has occasional hints about it. So you're not going to find an extended discussion of the subject in the Bible because it's simply not a major subject in the Bible. What happens when we're here is the major subject of the Bible. How do you obey Jesus? Sure. How do you live as a disciple? That we go to be with the Lord when we die is a positive thing that's mentioned, but it's never the focus of any biblical writer. But I would say that Jesus also, when he was talking to the Pharisees or the Sadducees about the doctrine of the resurrection, he talked about how, when God said to Moses, "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob," and Jesus said, "God is not the God of the living, of the dead, but of the living," Jesus said, "For all people live to him." Now, I don't remember if that's in Mark's version. I don't believe he says it in Matthew's version. It's either in Mark's or Luke's version. I don't have time to look it up right now. But Jesus makes the statement about people in the context of people who've died and says, "For all live to him," which seems to suggest that even if they're not alive to us, in other words, they've died among and don't live among us, they're alive to God. And okay. I'm sorry I don't have that reference because it's when Jesus is talking to the Sadducees in the final week, in the Passion Week of his life, and it's not in Matthew's version, but I believe it's in Mark's, but it could be in Luke's. I don't have time to look it up because my lines are full.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate your time and your wisdom and insight and all this.
All right, Paul, I appreciate your call. God bless you. Marie from Seattle, Washington is next. Marie, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Grateful for your show.
Thank you.
My question is, my husband and I are both believers, and we're looking to have some remodeling done on our home, and we went into a showroom, and we're looking at items, and we looked up, and there was one of the gods, I think a Hindu idol, up on the shelf with some offering, and it just surprised us, and we, went on looking, but it's just stuck in my mind, and, we have other options of businesses to go through. But I, if we did go with them, my question is that something, how would God see that? Is that honoring to him? I know we live in a world that there's lots of idols, but anyways.
Even people who don't have Hindu idols have other idols if they're not Christians. Their money can be their idol, or they may idolize something else. Unfortunately, idolatry is the natural state of the heart of fallen man until they repent of it. And so Hindus are simply more overt than others about their idols because they make statues of them and burn incense to them. People who aren't Hindus, they have every bit as much idols in many cases. So you can't guarantee that going to a different store that doesn't have a Hindu god and incense and so forth burned to it, you can't guarantee that you're supporting a more godly business. I would suggest, though, that when we have the opportunity to buy from Christians, I would rather do that just because they're brothers. If you had a sibling, a natural brother or sister who owned a furniture store and you were looking for furniture, you'd probably go there first and probably give them preference. Even if they couldn't beat the prices of other stores, you'd probably say, "Well, he's my brother. I'm going to do it for him." And I would think that when that option exists, I would think it's a very good thing. Not because of any superstitious notion that there's some spiritual danger or sin in buying products from non-Christians. It's more a matter of, you know, everyone's struggling and our obligation to the family of Christ. Remember Paul said in Galatians 6:10, he said, as you have opportunity, do good to all people, but especially those of the household of faith. So it's good to patronize non-Christian places too, but more good to patronize Christian establishments just because they are brothers and you want to, you know, want to see them succeed.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, and that was just my question. Obviously, probably nothing wrong with going with it, but maybe look for a Christian company and support them. So it is significantly lower. That's the tempting part. It's quite a good deal.
But if you find a Christian establishment, you could tell them that that particular product was available over at such and such a place for such and such a price, and let them know and see if they can approximate that price.
Right.
And if they say, we're a small company, we don't have quite the flexibility on the profit margins those people do, but we can get closer to it, you know. In other words, if you had to pay a little more to support a Christian, that's between you and God. But to me, if I had the choice to support a Christian, even if it's going to be a little bit more out of my pocket, if it's a reasonable price, I probably would choose the Christian just because I'm more interested in Christians than I'm in money.
Yeah, right. That's true. Well, I appreciate your opinion. I'm really thankful for that. So thank you very much.
All right, Marie. Thank you for your call. God bless you. All right. Another Paul, this time from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Hey, I was listening to your three views on hell recently, and you cited, I think it was Joseph Thayer, out of the rabbinical teachings, that they had a story similar to that of Jesus, the rich man, and Lazarus. Now, you said you never came across that, but, you know, I'm up in the air about this, you know, in the teaching, at least that's what you said. I'm up in the air on the source of, you know, this story, but to me, it's almost like, I don't know if you've found that source since you've taught that, but I'm kind of I don't know, I guess miffed as like, you know, throwing that story that Jesus gives. And if you could give me a chance to respond to you too before you go to the, you know, next call, I'd like to just one more response on that if there's a possibility. But
sure.
But,
well, let me just say about that story. The lectures you heard are many, many years old. Since that time, I did the research and wrote my book on the three views of hell. And I cover that considerably more thoroughly in my book because when I was writing my book, I did far more research than I had done before I gave those lectures. And it was true.
Oh, good.
It was true. When I'd done those lectures, it was only a rumor I had heard that there were rabbinic stories that were very, very similar to the story of Lazarus and the rich man. In my research, I found that virtually all New Testament scholars agree that that is the case, but not just one story, but the rabbis had several stories that had basically the same scenario that Jesus uses. Two men die, one is in hell, the other is in Abraham's bosom, and there's a conversation between them and so forth, and that these stories taught by the rabbis were not regarded to be true any more than Jesus' parables were considered to be true. They were illustrative of something. Now, one of the sources I quote that I cite in my book said that there's one university has something like 17 stories that have been collected from rabbinic writings that have this basic motif and this basic structure. And you'll find that even people who are totally committed to the most traditional view of hell, scholars like Craig Blomberg admit that the story of Lazarus and the rich man was really pretty much something borrowed from rabbinic writings. So it's not just people who have alternate views of hell that point this out or use it as an argument. It's kind of a general, I didn't know it until I did my research for the book, but I found that many, many scholars of very mainstream traditional scholars mentioned this, that the story has many parallels in the rabbinic literature.
So I guess to kind of follow up question, and then I'll let you go, and appreciate your time. Then the you know, obviously Tartarus, Sheol, the place of the dead, the words, the Valley of Hinnom, you know, talk, as you were talking about Jeremiah. So what actually then, you know, do you believe happens, you know, to say someone who rejects God their whole life and curses and spurns God, and I mean wicked men like, you know, I mean, who just, you know, killed millions and millions of people, I mean, some of the most heinous people on planet Earth, and then they die, and what happens to them?
Well, you mean immediately or after the judgment?
If you want to cover two of them, that's fine, if you feel like you got time, but if not, I totally understand.
Well, the reason I ask that is there's a distinction. For example, the story of Lazarus and the rich man does not describe anyone after the judgment day. It's describing somebody immediately after they die. And yet the Bible teaches that when Jesus comes back, everyone will be raised from the dead and there will be a judgment day. And then those who are not found written in the book of life will be cast into the lake of fire. So you've got, you know, the situation of the lost right after they die. You know, once their bodies are in the grave and until Jesus comes back at the last judgment, judges them and puts them in the lake of fire, you know, what is their condition there in the interval between death and the resurrection? And the other question is what happens to them ultimately for eternity? On the first question, we have almost nothing in the Bible except the story of Lazarus and the rich man. Actually, there are a number of things, as I told the previous caller, in the Bible that suggests something about where Christians go when they die. But as far as where non-Christians go when they die, it's not really addressed at all in any direct passage of teaching, except very possibly in this one story where a man dies and is seen to be in the flames of hell. Now, if he is actually in hell, if this is a true story, then we know something about the situation, that those who are wicked go to be in flames to await the judgment, and then they're thrown in the lake of fire, which is something else. Now, if the story is not intended as a true story, if Jesus realizes that he and his listeners are very much aware that he's simply citing a parable that was used by the rabbis, and that he's making a point, but the point is something other than the question of where people go when they die, and that does seem to be the case in the story. Its main point is not what happens to people after they die. The main point is that which is found in the last verse. If they don't listen to law and the prophets, then they won't believe even if a man rises from the dead. That seems to be the lesson of the story, rather than giving us some kind of authorized insight into what happens to people after they die. But if it is a true story, then it does give us that insight. If it's a parable, then we have to ask, how much is it really telling us about the state of people after the dead, and what is the point it's trying to make? So that's uncertain. But apart from that story, the Bible pretty much doesn't say anything about where people go when they die if they're not saved. But it does say that in the resurrection, all people will stand before the great white throne and they'll be judged. And all whose names are not found written in the book of life will be cast into the lake of fire.
Okay. So that's the part of Revelation. That's the part of Revelation. I know you've in the past cited Revelation. I'm trying to think of the term that you used, that there was a lot of that type of literature. So
apocalyptic, you know, yeah.
Yeah, apocalyptic literature, exactly. So how do you distinguish, then, if it's apocalyptic and it's, you know, the real deal? You know what I'm saying? You know, how do you differentiate when you're reading the book of Revelation? Okay, this is, you know, apocalyptic, and there was apocalyptic writing. And, you know, how do you discern that maybe when Jesus is talking about the great white throne of judgment, that that's some not, you know, some type of, you know, apocalyptic or, you know,
right,
different kind of teaching.
I understand.
Along that line, or some type of new type of apocalyptic teaching that he's
right.
Giving.
I understand the question, and I don't have much time to answer it, so let me try. Apocalyptic literature in general is symbolic. It is, of course, based upon real scenarios, but they are described in visions that use symbols. For example, the devil is symbolized as a dragon. Jesus is symbolized as a lamb. A political anti-Christian entity is symbolized as a beast with seven heads and ten horns. These are symbolic descriptions, not literal ones. Now, of course, the realities they're talking about are real realities, literal realities. Jesus is a literal person. The devil's a literal entity, and so forth. Likewise, the lake of fire, there is a literal place, apparently, the lake of fire. Now, the story is told in very symbolic terms, And I would say one reason we know the lake of fire and the judgment, the final judgment, are true is because Jesus talked about it also. For example, in Matthew 25, in the story of the sheep and the goats, we find Jesus talking about the final judgment and people being sent either into everlasting fire or into everlasting life, which resembles what it says in Revelation 20. And yet the parables are not apocalyptic. They are parables, but they are another way of getting a point across. I'm sorry, I'd love to go into this more, but as you can tell, the music's playing. I'm off of here about 30 seconds. But Paul, give me a call again. It's good to talk to you again, by the way. God bless you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website if you want to. That's thenarrowpath.com. And use the website, even if you don't donate, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.